Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rights On for Women, hosted by Dr. Joyce Starr on rightsradio.com. Each special show offers you the sizzling empowerment, savory wit, and sweet inspiration you just can't live without. Are you ready for revelations about your homeowner rights, pet care rights, natural health rights, consumer rights, and more? Good. You're in the right place. Here is Dr. Joyce Starr.
Good morning. This is Dr. Joyce Starr with Rights Radio and our special topic today on shareholder rights and stock fraud, security fraud, and Ponzi schemes, embezzlement, everything you can think of. What are your rights? Our guest is Jason Leviton. He is an expert on this topic. He's an attorney and a litigation rights expert on shareholder issues. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Joyce. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. I know you're not in your office. You're on vacation, and you joined us anyway. I'm so happy about that.
Oh, not a problem.
Jason, tell us a little bit about your law firm and what you do.
I work at a law firm, Cohen, Milstein, Sellers & Toll in Washington, D.C., and we specialize, at least the practice group I'm in securities class action litigation. Basically, when a company is alleged, is accused to have alleged a securities fraud violation, we protect shareholder rights by suing on behalf of all shareholders.
Well, we are now faced with the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Can you explain to our listeners how this could have happened?
Well, it's very interesting. You're speaking of Bernard Madoff, who, interestingly, was the former head of the NASDAQ stock exchange, and he was also the founder of Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities. People call them BMIS. And basically, what had happened was he was paying long-time shareholders in his scheme using monies that were brought in by old shareholders. So basically, if person A entered into the Ponzi scheme in 1986, they were receiving returns from investors that had just begun investing in 2008. So as new investors came in, they were paying the returns of an old investor. Basically, a Ponzi scheme is a fancy word for a pyramid scheme, which I think probably most people have heard about, which is, you know, the schemes where, you know, if there's one person on top, and then that person brings in two investors, and then those two investors each bring in two investors, and then those four investors bring in two investors each. And as you can see, it's basically the top of the pyramid is the one, and as it goes down, it forms a pyramid. Now, a pyramid scheme is considered a security, which means they are regulated by the federal securities laws. They're illegal because eventually you're not selling a product. All you're doing is you're selling an investment into a vehicle in which is being invested by new people. But because there is no product, it is a scheme, and eventually the pyramid will run out.
Well, you've explained that so well, in fact, better than most articles I've read, and I want to apologize if you hear drilling in the background, because we've been living with that in our area for over the last year and a half. So forgive the drilling, listeners, because what Jason has to say is much more important. Now, going on there, how is it that the SEC could not find out what was going on and was investigating it and dropped the case? How did this happen?
Well, again, very interesting question. You know, as you know, a little background on the scheme. It is alleged to have defrauded shareholders out of approximately $50 billion. So it is a massive scheme. And again, you know, the interesting thing is that the SEC had been receiving complaints about this since about 2005, 2006. And they had just kind of I don't want to say drop the ball, because I don't want to put that much blame on them. But basically, you know, they had basically turned a blind eye and had not shut this thing down.
Well, how can they turn a blind eye? I mean, how do you turn a blind eye to something so massive that was obviously detected years ago?
Well, again, it's interesting. You know, the reading on this shows that several hedge funds and investment managers had basically refused to get involved in the scheme because, you know, it seemed a little too good to be true. You know, that's something that you and the investors need to really hone in on. Something that seems a little too good to be true almost always is. And, you know, there were several investment managers and even hedge funds that said there's absolutely no way this individual, Bernard Madoff, could have been giving the returns that he was giving over the period of time that he was giving them. It just didn't add up.
8% a year, I believe, right? 8% a year?
It's true. And, you know, in the market, with the volatility in the market, nobody is going to always post returns. I believe since the creation of the fund, it had posted a loss once, maybe twice. And that just isn't possible, especially in the subprime debacle that we're in now. So the SEC had received complaints, and basically, I don't know if they investigated it at all or not. My guess is they kind of looked at Mr. Madoff and said, well, he can't be doing anything that wrong. I mean, he is the head or was the chairman of the NASDAQ, and I think name recognition went a long way in protecting him.
But how has he managed to juggle all these balls for so many years? One would have to conclude that he's a genius when it comes to cooking the books, because it's gone on and on and on and on. I mean, he had to really work hard to keep delivering money.
I mean, again, the interesting part is that the scheme was extremely basic, actually. All he was doing, as I said earlier, is paying old investors with new money.
But that means he had to keep bringing in the new money.
He did. He did have to keep bringing in investors. But, you know, when you're Bernard Madoff, you have a big phone book. You know, you have a big black book and some very wealthy people, and you can keep bringing in individuals, at least for a long time. Now, the interesting thing, and here's another tip for you, you know, for the people listening and yourself as well, is not only when something seems too good to be true, it probably is, you really need to look at the people that they're working with. The accountants that he was using was a firm that nobody had ever heard of. I had certainly never heard of them, and many of the stories I had read basically said, we don't know who these people are. It was operating, one story I read said that it was operating, the firm's name is Freely and Horowitz, and they might be a very good accounting firm, I have no idea. But, you know, a fund the size of, you know, BMIS would generally use somebody like KPMG, you know, Grant Thornton, something that everybody had heard of. This firm, Freeling and Horowitz, and I should say this, I have read absolutely nothing that says they are that they were involved in the scheme. I don't know if they were. My guess is until somebody tells me otherwise, I'll assume they were not. But, you know, it's a small accounting firm that basically was run out of Rockland County, New York. They had one partner who lived in Florida, an accountant and a secretary. You know, and they were basically operated out of a 13 by 18 foot space, you know, in Rockland County. That is not typically the type of accounting firm that would be used for a fund the size of BMIS. It just isn't. And I think that gave a lot of pause to a lot of hedge funds and a lot of investment managers that kind of said, we just don't get why he would use this type of accounting firm. And he was also extremely secretive, Bernard Madoff, that is, about his investments and where they were going. You know, another interesting thing that I had read basically said it made no sense for a fund this big that was apparently buying and selling stock to never leave a quote-unquote footprint on the market, meaning that when a huge fund, for example, let's say somebody like Bill Gates, when Bill Gates buys a security, everybody notices because he doesn't buy 100 shares or 1,000 shares. He buys 1,000,000 shares, and that is a huge amount that is being purchased from the market. If he does that, generally the stock price increases. If he then sells those 1,000,000 shares, the stock price generally decreases because there's much higher supply. Because, again, he's not buying 800 or even 1,000 shares. He's buying, you know, 1,000,000 shares. But this BMIS investment vehicle wasn't leaving those types of footprints. And I think that gave a lot of people pause, because if a $50 billion fund is buying, you know, $100 million worth of a security, it should have some impact on that security's price. And people just weren't seeing that.
I think that's a really important point. I haven't seen a much mention of that fact. And indeed, combined with the accountants, wouldn't you think that people like Steven Spielberg or those who were Zuckerman or others who were head of major organizations, some put $250 million into this fund, why didn't they ask these questions?
Interesting question. My guess is that Steven Spielberg or his investment team will be asking them the same exact question. But, you know, like Grupo Santander, you know, they had purchased, you know, or at least risk exposure of over $3 billion. You know, the Man Group has exposure of, you know, approximately $360 million. The Royal Bank of Scotland, you know, has exposure of $600 million. I mean, you're talking about very, very large numbers from very large organizations. And again, the obvious question is, did they not look into it? Did they just buy it because of his name? You know, were they swindled? Those are going to be questions that I can pretty much guarantee you and the listeners will be asked by attorneys, including myself.
Now, let's get into that, because one of the things that we learned from you on our first Rights Radio show that we where we featured you, and was a wonderful show, what we learned is that that the SEC simply doesn't have the resources to do what it's supposed to do, and law firms pick up the cudgel.
It's true. The SEC is a fantastic organization, but, you know, you need to look at the top of it. You know, right now the chairman is Christopher Cox. I assume he is looking out for shareholder rights. But, you know, their court filings have showed quite consistently recently them taking the side of business, which is, to me, very, very shocking that the organization, the governmental-sponsored organization that's in charge of regulating the securities market, has filed amicus briefs at courts throughout the country, including the Supreme Court, really trying to limit the rights of shareholders. You know, it will be very interesting to see how the new administration deals with these same issues. You know, my understanding is that the head of FINRA, which is an organization, again, that is, you know, in charge of regulating the markets, the head of FINRA, a woman, and I just forgot her name, will be the chairman of the SEC. And it will be interesting to see if their position changes. My guess is that it will.
I think this is a little unnerving, that they're filing briefs against shareholder rights.
Well, what they would argue is that it's not that they're filing briefs, you know, against shareholder rights, but that they are trying to protect the markets in a way that would, you know, protect long-term investments. But I can tell you that that has not been, at least in my view, that has not been what's actually been occurring. You know, when you file a brief in the Supreme Court asking the